I walked around for a while, and at dusk ended up in front of a cheap restaurant. The owner noticed me and offered to let me stay overnight. The next morning, he offered me a job. I stayed there 5 years. I cooked, served the customers, cleaned up, and did odd jobs. When I was 15, I began to work for Monsieur Bailly as his first assistant. Bailly's pastry shop had important customers, Talleyrand and Bonaparte. Monsieur Bailly allowed me to study. Our shop was very near the National Library. I taught myself to read. I copied architectural drawings. I started to make pastry creations based on these renderings. As everyone knows, the principal branch of architecture is pastry. After working for Monsieur Bailly, I bought a pastry shop. Having my own shop meant I could sell my meringues, which people loved. When the revolution finally came to an end, people were able to relax. Restaurants were opened by former chefs of the aristocrats. Former aristocrats were looking for jobs around Napoleon. An enormous amount of networking occurred at dinner tables. Tout le monde wanted tout l'argent. Before I continue, I would like to introduce you to Lady Morgan, who was a great help to me and my place in history.
Hello, I'm Lady Morgan. Well, I'm not really Lady Morgan. She's dead, like all the other characters in this piece. But I'm going to represent her as far as this project is concerned. My books, often inspired by Irish folklore, became rather popular in London and Dublin. Pourquoi pas? I was a blue stocking, thirsty for literature, history, and politics. If you don't know what a blue stocking is, you'll just have to look it up. I went to Paris at the beginning of the Restoration, and if I say so myself, became the darling of the ultras, that extreme party whose aim was the complete undoing of the social and political work of the revolution.
Liberté, égalité, fraternité.
They were a bit shocked when they learned of various aspects of my life that I had never hidden. Les amours, you know what I mean. My relationships with Lafayette and Benjamin Constant, and my liberal ideology. True, I'd lost admirers among the ultras, but I did remain a fashionable woman. Not to brag, but I was the first woman granted a pension by the British government for services rendered to the cause of letters. Also, I was the only person who ever bothered to write about the magnificent work of Carême when he was still alive. Enough about me. Now, back to the story.
One of these former aristocrats, who was quite a grand gourmet, was Maurice de Talleyrand Périgord. On the revolution's death list, and unwelcome in England, he went to America. After the terror, he returned to Paris and became foreign minister.
My name is Talleyrand. I first noticed Carême in the shop of Monsieur Bally. At that time, Carême was only 17. And he was already Bally's first assistant. At that time, there was a great demand for edible architectonic constructions. These constructions would decorate the buffet table, and at the end of the evening, they were taken apart and given to the servants to eat. In 1804, I hired Carême as chief pâtissier of the Grand Extravaganza, and he stayed with me until 1815. Lunch was of little importance. My dinner in general would consist of two soups, two removes, including one of fish, four entrees, two roasts, four sweets, and of course, dessert.
During the whole dinner, the conversation was devoted to food and wine. Every dish produced strong opinions, and the age of each wine furnished the occasion with an eloquent commentary. Talleyrand analyzed the dinner as intensely as if he were discussing a crucial political problem. It was fantastique. J'ai faim just thinking about it. Dessert is the special course of the hostess or host. One takes great care with its creation. However, at dinners for men, some of the guests avoid sweet desserts, preferring aged cheese with a glass of sherry.
One evening, my dinner guests were praising the cheeses of their country. I listened, and I thought that this would be the perfect moment to summon my valet. He arrived and announced that a courier had just arrived from Paris, bringing intelligences from the court and a case of brie cheese. That's how brie was introduced to the world. As Molière said, the best host is the host who serves dinner.
Thank you.
seasonal breaks from rich food. Lent was respected by the aristocrats. Gourmets considered Lent with its simple food to be a healthy intermission. Doctors knew it was good business to discuss diet with the chefs of the great houses.
I loved my work, even though the conditions were not always the best. Sometimes I didn't have a moment to eat before 5 p.m., and my assistants and I worked until 11 p.m. The ball at Neuilly in 1806 was an example of our difficult conditions. Insects, which we called little black beasts, were everywhere. We had to constantly chase them away from the oven in order to protect the pastries. Insects were very interested in desserts. One day I saw a large number of them caught in a pot filled with water. That gave me the idea of surrounding the oven and other strategic locations with pots of jam filled with a sugary liquid. It was a good idea. Soon after setting up this system, I had an assistant count the number of insects captured overnight. 1,215. At 7 p.m., the 16 big mounted pieces and the side dishes were put on display.
Bravo.
This was the beginning of the end of the Napoleonic era. French attempts at military and political dominance in Europe were failing. Allied nations were fighting back. When the Russian allies arrived close to Paris, Talleyrand had a special assignment for me as head chef. After Marmont, the commander of the French troops signed the surrender document confirming that Tsar Alexander had taken Paris. He ran to Talleyrand to report the bad news. Of course, Talleyrand was secretly delighted to have Napoleon out of the way as a step in his plan to crown Louis XVIII king, with a place for himself as the Minister of Foreign Affairs. He immediately said to his assistant,
"We must get Marmont to eat before we can get him to talk."
Oui.
And of course, toward the end of the divine meal which I prepared, Marmont began to relax and share his strategic insights.
"This bottle of wine is from 1804. It's a Bordeaux, what the British call a claret. It's a Chateau Pontécané. And it's a wine I enjoy especially. It is light, charming. It has a wonderful bouquet and quite a bit of complexity. I like to serve it to my interlocutor, and I notice that very quickly they enjoy themselves very much. And then I go to them and I talk about the affair of the state.
When the Tsar went back to his temporary palace in the Élysée Napoléon, he invited me to go with him. I was now chief chef of the Emperor of Russia. The Tsar knew how much I could help him at this moment when he had become the effective leader of Europe. He was intent on having his dinner table celebrate his new leadership and knew I was the man to support the concept. I was absolute master of my domain, in charge of all decisions about staff and budgets. I found a new ally in Müller, the imperial household's chief of staff. Müller quickly came to understand whom he was dealing with. He continually gave me signs of respect and even of affection.
Oi, 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 oi. was sent to work for the Tsar. You were the sugar on my creme brulee. I wanted to be with you every day.
I stayed there for a year, at which time I returned to Talleyrand.
Ah, Napoléon, le petit Bonaparte. Mais vous savez, il avait pas mal commencé. Il avait quelques idées généreuses et puis il s'est pris au sérieux. Il s'est pris pour un empereur et à partir de ce moment-là, ça a été la décadence. On a sombré rapidement dans le ridicule d'une cour qui n'était pas une véritable cour royale, qui était une cour de manants, de va-nu-pieds. Et c'est pourquoi je n'ai pas eu beaucoup de scrupules, en 1814, à contribuer à son départ définitif.
From the moment he arrived, Talleyrand became a person of acute concern to the Austrian police. They were particularly baffled over one member of his entourage. They knew she was there, but no one had ever seen her. They knew only one detail. She took her meals in Talleyrand's rooms. At night, agents heard music playing until dawn. After some weeks of investigation, they discovered the person was Ingrid, an Austrian, a musician in Talleyrand's service. At night, he sat in his study, motionless for hours, meditating while Ingrid would play her instruments in muted tones.
Louis XVI, anxiously inquired whether Talleyrand needed additional staff from the embassy.
Sire, I need cooks more than diplomats.
Vienna accused France of being an accomplice of Napoleon. Prussia, Austria, and Russia demanded to overtake France. Talleyrand had to separate the cause of Napoleon from that of the French people and to plead for them. To accomplish this, he plunged into a whirl of parties and social interactions. He indoctrinated the ladies of the court. At dinner parties, at balls, and in bed, everyone was given the message. The ladies were encouraged to use their charismatic powers. Observing the activities of Europe's nobility, Talleyrand commented,
"In Vienna, the cooking is done in the bedroom."
Also bei uns in Wien wird das Essen in der Küche im Badezimmer gemacht.
champagne, champagne. I've always considered the most perfect drink. If you are very busy, if the neighboring country are creating trouble, a little glass of champagne will go a long way to help you see through the crisis. If, on the contrary, you have a happy days, these bubbles will add a great deal to your happiness. It is also, should I say, a drink that fits very well in the bedroom.
I wrote everything I cooked. Each evening, when I returned to my room, I would document everything I had prepared. In 1815, my first book was published, Le Pâtissier Royal Parisien. In 1816, I left for England to work for the Prince Regent, the future King George IV. I could not stand England. The climate, the popular dishes. I couldn't wait to leave. As Lady Morgan said, England, boxes of brick, faces of flesh. I turned down an offer from a British lord so that I could devote myself to my literary work. In 1823, I began to work for Baron Rothschild. I had the good luck to find a situation compatible with my interests and my desire to stay in France. I became the chef of Monsieur Rothschild at a salary going well beyond what any ruling European monarch could have paid. I was able to write my next book, Cuisinier Parisien, which was published in 1828.
It was not without emotion that I heard the announcement of dinner. To do justice to the science and research needed to prepare a dinner such as this would require a knowledge of culinary art equal to that of its creator. Its characteristics were consistency with the season and conformity with the spirit of the times. There was nothing old-fashioned in its composition. No trace in any of the dishes of the customs of our ancestors. No spicy sauces, no dark brown gravies, no cayenne pepper or four-spice seasoning, no pickles. No trace either of the intervention of fire or water, those vulgar elements in the cuisine of long ago. The basis of all the preparations consisted of the most delicate essences of the various meats, prepared with a chemist's precision in rosy silver. Each meat conserved its own natural aroma, and each vegetable its own fresh color. The mayonnaise had been beaten in a vessel surrounded by ice. The sherbet, replacing the tiresome soufflés and fondues of English tables, announced the imminent shock about to be delivered by an exquisite avalanche of freshly harvested mandarin oranges, satisfying all the senses and dissipating all other perfumes. Thank you.
Thanks to you, madame, my fame has been nobly enhanced by the enchanting passage which you deigned to write about the dinner at Boulogne of July 6th, 1829. That dinner will become as famous in the gastronomic history of modern France as the feasts of Emmaus and Ulysses, of Achilles when he received in his tent the Greek deputies who came to invite him to reconcile with Agamemnon, as the feasts of Elitius, the supper of Mark Antony and Cleopatra, the dinners of Messene, the feast of Trimalcion and the three Epicyuses, as the feasts of Chantilly, which are so renowned in the history of French gastronomy.
Finding myself seated next to Monsieur Rothschild, I said to him, after the soup, how could one dare say a word before that, that I felt not altogether unworthy of being invited to a carême dinner. Although I'd been accused of being attracted to the red hat, my true vocation was that of the white hat. I said to him that although I had for a long time known the theoretical works of Monsieur Carême, this new first-hand experience of the practical applications of his theories inspired me with an even greater admiration of his towering talent. Well then, answered Monsieur Rothschild, laughing, he too is an admirer of your works, and here is the proof. I blushed upon discovering a bust of myself created from sugar. Sucrière. Take notice, you editors who have never written my name except with venom. Lady Morgan in sugar. And this at a party, including some of the most important personalities of the Holy Alliance. I just couldn't believe it. C'est incroyable.
Thank you.
The role of the chef maître d'hôtel requires the qualities of a general in a battle campaign. He should be ready for active command and armed with an invincible love of work. A man in control, he sees and knows all. He will never miss the decisive moment, knowing that to do so may lead to defeat in battle and collision of the forces. The maître d'hôtel is never sick, never. He presides over everything, starting at 3 a.m. He energizes everything with his powerful force. He alone has the right to raise his voice and make everyone give way. You will recognize him as a general at the moment of action. At his command, each force is served, cleared, each brigade is in motion. Whether the banquet is for a dozen guests or 300, he can take any situation in his stride. I lost consciousness. In this state, I awoke once and had a lucid memory of my profession. It was the end of the evening. One of my favorite pupils wanted to see me and speak to me. After some questions made in a loud voice, I reopened my eyes and recognized the pupil's voice.
Is it you? Thank you, my good friend. Tomorrow, send me some fish. Yesterday, the sole dumplings were very good. But your fish wasn't good. You didn't season it properly. Listen, you have to gently shake the casserole. Thank you.